Hitchman's introductory letter is also important. Is it a public relations puff piece, or is there a genuine desire to communicate what's going on? I want to avoid promotional companies that are bent on showing things in the best possible light. By contrast, when Berkshire released the offering document for its B-class shares, it candidly stated that Warren and Charlie wouldn't buy them at that price. After working my way through the corporate filings, I typically turn to less objective corporate documents. Things like earnings announcements, press releases, and transcripts of conference calls. There might also be helpful information to glean from a book about the company or its founder. These are fairly useful if they're not just vanity pieces, since many hours of work have gone into them. In some cases, they have such depth that I'd read them before the corporate filings. Investors looking at Berkshire for the first time would do well to read the books that Roger Lowenstein and Alice Schroeder wrote about Buffett. Likewise, in studying Walmart, a good place to start would be Sam Walton's book, Made in America. These ideas about the sequencing of information may seem trite, but minor shifts in how we operate can have a major impact. By consistently improving the way I consume information, I'm looking to create better conditions for success over many years. Still, we're all wired differently, so my idea of a healthy and balanced informational diet may be different from yours. The Wall Street Journal once noted that Buffett had a small TV in his office, tuned to CNBC, but with the volume muted. I'd find it terribly distracting to have a TV at work, as it would stimulate my brain in unhelpful ways. I also try, and sometimes fail, to minimize my exposure to the internet, which can lead me in a thousand different directions. It requires a lot of mental energy to read a web page with all its links to other information. I don't want my mind chain to be yanked, so I prefer to read the physical editions of things like The Wall Street Journal, The Financial Times, The Economist, Barron's, Fortune, Bloomberg Business Week, and Forbes, along with more abstruse publications like American Banker and the International Railway Journal. Still, I avoid reading any press coverage until after I've studied the corporate filings. There are plenty of good journalists who provide useful context and insight, but for my purposes, it's important not to prioritize news stories, since they give my brain reasons to act, often without providing real substance. The corporate filings are my meat and vegetables, less enjoyable, but usually more nutritious. As for the equity research published by brokerage firms, I read little of it and I never rely on it. Once I'm finished with all of my other research, I sometimes pull up these reports so I know what Wall Street is saying about a company or industry, but I'm careful to make this research the last thing I read so that I've already formed my own impression. I don't deny that there are smart people working on the sell side. In some cases, they provide remarkable insight, particularly about industry dynamics, so it would be unwise and unfair to dismiss an entire community. But their work is paid for by brokerage dollars. When I read it, I'm exposing myself to Wall Street, which is one big selling machine. Also, my goal in creating all of these habits is to get out of sync with the markets. Moving in lockstep with them is a recipe for average results. The rule? Pay attention to the order in which you consume information, and don't eat your dessert until you've finished your meat and vegetables. 5. Discuss your investment ideas only with people who have no axe to grind. By now, I probably sound like some weird mix of social outcast and appalling snob, refusing to speak with CEOs, sell-side analysts, or anyone else from the world of sales. Many of them are no doubt charming, upstanding citizens with mortgages to pay and angelic children to support. But in my eyes, their underlying sales agenda is a fatal flaw. So, is there anyone that I am actually happy to speak with about potential investments? Good question, thanks for asking. If I want somebody else's perspective, and I often do, I find it more useful to seek out the opinion of a trusted peer on the buy side. Over the years, I've had invaluable discussions with investors like Nick Sleep, Chris Hon, Bill Ackman, Stephen Wallman, Alan Bonello, Ken Shubinstein, Dante Albertini, Jonathan Brandt, and Greg Alexander. All of them have taught me a great deal without trying to teach me anything. In my experience, the best people to speak with about investments aren't just intelligent, but have an ability to keep their ego out of the conversation. As a result, these discussions tend to be playful and fun, and they don't disturb my calm pond. Increasingly, the person I speak with most about potential investments is Monish, partly because his analytical gifts are off the charts, but also because he doesn't have any axe to grind. I found that investment discussions work best when they adhere to three ground rules that I borrowed from groups like the Young President's Organization. First, the conversation must be strictly confidential. Second, neither person can tell the other what to do, as this tends to make people feel judged, so they become defensive. In fact, it helps if you don't even know whether the other person is thinking of buying or selling the stock, since that knowledge muddies the waters. Third, we can't have any business relationship, because this could skew the conversation by adding a subtle or not-so-subtle financial agenda. Of course, what matters most in these conversations is mutual trust, so no action should be taken unless the other person gives clear permission. If I'm interested in buying the stock or discussing it with someone else, I need to ask specifically if that's okay. If it's not, I can't do it. The goal of these conversations isn't to reach the right answer or engage in intelligent debate, it's to share our experiences and information. To achieve this, it helps to ask open-ended questions. For example, instead of asking what a company will earn next year, it's more useful to ask something like, what needs to happen for them to generate a lot of cash next year? I remember a specific conversation that I had with Shai Dardashti, a money manager friend who has given me permission to share what we discussed. At the time, he was researching K-Swiss, a manufacturer of athletic shoes. I had done a lot of research into Nike and had looked at the impact of its sponsorship on tennis and soccer. Instead of telling Shai that I thought K-Swiss was an also-ran in the sneaker business, I suggested that he produce a list of the top 20 tennis players, see who sponsored them, then estimate which of those players attracted the most viewers in what is typically a winner-takes-all market. In the process, he discovered that K-Swiss had only one player on the list, while Nike had six or seven, an indication that K-Swiss faced an all but insuperable challenge to win market share away from Nike. At no point did we discuss whether Shai already owned the stock or was thinking of buying it, but I'm guessing that our discussion helped to clarify that it wasn't the best place for him to invest. The rule: pool your knowledge with other investors, but stick with people who can keep their ego in check. If the other person happens to be Buffett, Munger, or Pabrai, so much the better. 6. Never buy or sell stocks when the market is open. Wall Street is perfectly designed to take advantage of weaknesses in the human brain. For example, unscrupulous brokerages create well-honed scripts that enable their brokers to call their marks, I mean clients, to convince them to buy particular stocks. The underlying goal is to generate lucrative trading activity for the firm itself. As a long-term value investor, my interests are in stark opposition to the interests of Wall Street. What I need to do is simply invest in a handful of great but undervalued businesses and then stay put. Wall Street is rewarded for activity. My shareholders and I are rewarded for inactivity. To help myself function this way, I need a series of circuit breakers that slow me down and prevent me from acting precipitously. Some of these routines and procedures are so obvious that it might seem as if they are not even worth mentioning, but I found them immensely beneficial, and it doesn't take a lot of energy or thought to implement them. When it comes to buying and selling stocks, I need to detach myself from the price action of the market, which can stir up my emotions, stimulate my desire to act, and cloud my judgment. So I have a rule inspired by Monish that I don't trade stocks while the market is open. Instead, I prefer to wait until trading hours have ended. I then email one of my two brokers, preferring not to speak with them directly, and ask to trade the stock at the average price for the upcoming day. I'm not trying to get an edge on the market because I don't want to get swept up in its constant mood swings. As Ben Graham explained, we have to try to make the market our servant, not our master. Occasionally, I break this rule because there's a particularly compelling reason to trade a stock during market hours. As with all of these rules, the point is not to let them become a straitjacket, but to have them guide my behavior in a generally healthier direction. In the case of this trading rule, what matters is that I'm giving myself permission to disengage from the market. By contrast, in my early years as a fund manager, I had an in-house trading desk. This was a terrible idea because it brought the market into the heart of my office in a way that was even worse than having a Bloomberg terminal. I also used to talk directly to traders who would ask me questions like, "Do you want me to take a look on the floor and get some color on the market?" I didn't know any better, so I let myself be exposed to this head-spinning barrage of market action. All this information made me feel powerful and gave me an illusion of control. My view now is that we're simply not wired to deal with this constant flood of price information, but it took years for me to learn this, and also to develop the discipline to say, I'm just going to ignore all this noise. At first, this can be quite scary, but in my experience, it's marvelously liberating. The rule: keep the market at a safe distance. Don't let it invade your office or your brain. 7. If a stock tumbles after you buy it, don't sell it for 2 years. When a stock has surged, selling it can be a joy, but it can also be bittersweet, like parting with an old friend. When a stock has tumbled, selling it is even more emotionally fraught. After all, it's hard to make rational decisions about an investment that has already lost you a lot of money, since negative emotions such as remorse, self-loathing, and fear can short-circuit the ability to think clearly. Monish developed a rule to deal with the psychological forces aroused in these situations. If he buys a stock and it goes down, he won't allow himself to sell it for 2 years. He explained this to me around the time of our lunch with Warren Buffett, and it made so much sense that I instantly adopted this rule. Once again, it acts as a circuit breaker, a way to slow me down and improve my odds of making rational decisions. Even more important, it forces me to be more careful before buying a stock, since I know that I'll have to live with my mistakes for at least 2 years. That knowledge helps me to avoid a lot of bad investments. In fact, before buying a stock, I consciously assume that the price will immediately fall by 50%, and I ask myself if I'll be able to live through it. I then buy only the amount that I could handle emotionally if this were to happen. Monish's rule is a variation on an important idea that Warren has often shared with students. As Warren once put it, "I could improve your ultimate financial welfare by giving you a ticket with only 20 slots in it, so that you had 20 punches, representing investments that you got to make in a lifetime. And once you'd punched through the card, you couldn't make any more investments at all. Under those rules, you'd think really carefully about what you did, and you'd be forced to load up on what you'd really thought about, so you'd do much better." The rule: before buying any stock, make sure you like it enough to hold on for at least 2 years, even if the price halves right after you buy it. 8. Don't talk about your current investments. Over the years, I began to realize that it was a bad idea to speak publicly about stocks that I own. The issue isn't that other investors might steal my best ideas. The real problem is that it messes with my head. Once we've made a public statement, it's psychologically difficult to back away from what we've said, even if we've come to regret that opinion. So the last thing I want to do is walk into the trap of making a public statement about a stock, given that the situation might later change or that I might subsequently discover that I was wrong. I first encountered this idea in Munger's talk on the causes of human misjudgment, which led me to Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, Science and Practice. Cialdini described this peculiar feature of our mental wiring as the commitment and consistency principle. To demonstrate this idea, he wrote about a 1966 psychology experiment in which residents of Palo Alto were asked if they'd do something that wouldn't cost much money but would help their neighborhood. A few days later, they were asked to put an ugly sign on their front lawns to stop drivers speeding through the neighborhood. Residents who had previously committed to doing something inexpensive to help their neighborhood found it extraordinarily hard to change their stated position, so they typically felt obliged to install these signs on their lawns. Likewise, if you tell a child that you're going to give them a treat, they're liable to reply, "You promise?" They intuitively understand that you'll find it hard to reverse course after taking a position. I experienced this firsthand with a stock called EVCI, which I bought around 2003. Within 18 months, it surged sevenfold, making it the most successful investment I had made up to that point. As we'll discuss later, I should have sold all of my shares. But I had given an interview to Value Investor Insight, extolling EVCI as an example of my investing prowess. As a result, I was publicly invested in the stock and couldn't part with it even though it was no longer cheap. For various reasons, the stock subsequently halved. In retrospect, I could see that I would have been much better off if I'd never spoken about it, since this would have given me more latitude to sell once the circumstances changed. Still, it took me a long time to act on this knowledge and actually stop speaking publicly about my holdings. Sometimes it was necessary to disclose what I was doing. For example, after my fund was battered in the financial crisis, I needed to reassure my shareholders so that they wouldn't lose heart. I talked to them at length about current holdings such as Cresud and London Mining, making it clear that these were remarkably cheap stocks with great prospects. In 2010, after my fund had rebounded sharply, I finally made the change. I stopped discussing my current investments in public settings, including my annual meetings, interviews with journalists, and letters to shareholders. At first, this wasn't an easy shift to make. Once you create an expectation in the marketplace, it's difficult to reverse yourself without people feeling that they're being shortchanged. But this change in procedure was well worth the risk of leaving a few noses bent out of shape. I'm not dogmatic about this rule. If I'm chatting privately with a shareholder, I might end up talking about a particular stock that we own. But even in these private conversations, I try to remain neutral and understated, resisting the temptation to talk heatedly about why I think a stock is great. I know how hard it can subsequently be to make a decision that's inconsistent with these statements, so why create this potential headache when it's so easily avoidable? Instead of discussing current holdings in my letters to shareholders, I now provide a detailed post-mortem on stocks that I've already sold. This gives shareholders a clear insight into how their money is being invested, but it doesn't interfere with my ability to act as rationally as possible going forward. For me, this has certainly removed a psychological burden. I'd argue that most individual investors would also benefit from keeping quiet about their current investments, since this talk only makes it harder to operate in a rational way. It's so much easier when you don't have to worry about how other people might judge you. The rule: don't say anything publicly about your investments that you may live to regret. Chapter 11. An Investor's Checklist. Survival Strategies from a Surgeon. Even with a well-constructed environment and a robust set of investment rules, we're still going to mess up. The brain is simply not designed to work with meticulous logic through all of the possible outcomes of our investment decisions. The complexity of the business and economic world, combined with our irrationality in the face of money-related issues, guarantees that we'll make plenty of dumb mistakes. The habits and processes that we've discussed so far should help us to edge in the right direction, but there is one other investment tool that is so invaluable that it merits a chapter of its own: a checklist. The goal in creating a checklist is to avoid obvious and predictable errors. Before I make the final decision to buy any stock, I turn to my checklist in a last-ditch effort to prevent my unreliable brain from overlooking any potential warning signs that I might have missed. The checklist is the final circuit breaker in my decision-making process. The idea for this didn't originate with me, but with Atul Gawande, a former Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He is now a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, and a renowned author. He's a remarkable blend of practitioner and thinker, and also an exceptionally nice guy. In December 2007, Gawande published a story in The New Yorker entitled The Checklist, which drew heavily on his experience as a surgeon to explore a problem that is both profound and practical. As he put it, intensive care medicine has grown so far beyond ordinary complexity that avoiding daily mistakes is proving impossible even for our super specialists. As he explained, this reflects a fundamental challenge that exists in other fields too, namely the art of managing extreme complexity and the question of whether such complexity can, in fact, be humanly mastered. His article went on to describe the groundbreaking work of Peter Pronovost, a critical care specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, who designed a checklist after a particular patient nearly died. Pronovost took a single sheet of paper and listed all of the steps required to avoid the infection that had almost killed the man. These steps were all no-brainers, yet it turned out that doctors skipped at least one step with over a third of their patients. When the hospital began to use checklists, numerous deaths were prevented. This was partly because checklists helped with memory recall, especially with mundane matters that are easily overlooked, and partly because they made explicit the importance of certain precautions. Other hospitals followed suit, adopting checklists as a pragmatic way of coping with complexity. When Monish read Gawande's article, he had a eureka moment, instantly recognizing that the idea of a checklist could also be applied to investing, another field in which the complexity is so extreme that even super specialists routinely trip up, making easily preventable mistakes. In our case, it isn't fatal, but investing errors can be terribly costly to shareholders with their life savings on the line. I was sitting in my office in Manhattan one afternoon when Monish emailed me a copy of Gawande's article. We then spoke on the phone, and it was clear that he was really excited. Monish has the kind of mind that easily makes unusual connections, so it was immediately obvious to him that the checklist idea was a big deal. I thought it was interesting, but it took me longer to understand just how significant it might be. By now I'm used to the fact that Monish is quicker on the uptake than I am. I console myself by contemplating a sage observation of Buffett's. The key to life is figuring out who to be the bat boy for. As I realized long ago, there's no dishonor in being Monish's bat boy, far from it. And while I'm busy cloning Monish Pabrai, he's busy cloning Atul Gawande. Monish pursued the checklist idea with ferocious intensity and rigor. He began by marshalling a group of us to recall a slew of investing mistakes we had made. In each case, we had to work out why they had happened and if there was a cause that we should have seen beforehand. Sometimes I would look back at a situation where I had missed some vital clue, shake my head and say, "How did I not see that?" Monish added his own mistakes to the mix. We combined these with some infrequent errors that we had seen Buffett and Munger make, including their investments in NetJets, Dexter Shoe Company, and diversified retailing, a reminder that retail is a tougher place to make money than most people realize. Buffett, with characteristic candor, confessed in his 2007 letter to shareholders, "To date, Dexter is the worst deal I've made, but I'll make more mistakes in the future, you can bet on that." A line from Bobby Bear's country song explains what too often happens with acquisitions. "I've never gone to bed with an ugly woman, but I've sure woke up with a few." Monish and I also discussed Berkshire's ill-timed investment in Court Furniture in 2000. Court had made a fortune leasing furniture to startup companies during the heady years of the 1990s tech boom, but Buffett and Munger had underestimated just how vulnerable its profits would be when this bubble burst. Companies like eBay and Craigslist also ate into Court's sales by making it cheap and easy to buy used furniture. Munger later described this investment as a macroeconomic mistake. I helped Monish by carefully analyzing my own errors, along with those of other investors. Monish himself worked at such a breakneck pace that it was almost unnerving. After we had compiled our initial list of mistakes and the lessons we should draw from them, he hired a couple of graduate students from Harvard Business School to undertake a painstaking forensic investigation. They studied the 13F filings of about 20 smart value investors, including firms like Southeastern Asset Management and Fairholme Capital Management, counting as a mistake any investment they had sold at a loss. The students then read through the investors' public statements and annual letters to reconstruct the thinking behind these failed investments. Gawande himself became intrigued by what we were doing. He interviewed Monish and me, and he wrote a few pages about us in his 2009 bestseller, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. Among other things, he mentioned Monish's realization that he had repeatedly erred in underestimating the riskiness of leveraged companies. As I suggested to Gawande, part of the problem might lie in what I described as cocaine brain. The intoxicating prospect of making money can arouse the same reward circuits in the brain that are stimulated by drugs, making the rational mind ignore supposedly extraneous details that are actually very relevant. Needless to say, this mental state is not the best condition in which to conduct a cool and dispassionate analysis of investment risk. By the time I settled in Zurich, we had assembled a veritable cornucopia of cock-ups. These included several mistakes that Monish and I had made in the run-up to the credit crisis, when some of our stocks plunged by more than 80%. In our post-mortem analysis, we were able to explore where we had gone wrong and, more important, design checklist items that would help to prevent us from repeating those mistakes. Monish, who did the lion's share of the work in this whole endeavor, ended up grouping his checklist into about 6 broader categories, including themes such as leverage and corporate management. It's an incredible piece of intellectual property. My own checklist, which borrows shamelessly from his, includes about 70 items, but it continues to evolve. Before pulling the trigger on any investment, I pull out the checklist from my computer or the filing cabinet near my desk to see what I might be missing. Sometimes this takes me as little as 15 minutes, but it's led me to abandon literally dozens of investments that I might otherwise have made. In a typical case, I might conclude, okay, this stock is failing on 4 of my checklist items. On that basis, I'm unlikely to invest in it, but this isn't a black-and-white mechanical process. As I've discovered from having ADD, the mind has a way of skipping over certain pieces of information, including rudimentary stuff like where I've left my keys. This also happens during the investment process. The checklist is invaluable because it redirects and challenges the investor's wandering attention in a systematic manner. I sometimes use my checklist in the middle of the investing process to deepen my understanding of a company, but it's most useful right at the end as a way of backstopping myself. That said, it's important to recognize that my checklist should not be your checklist. This isn't something you can outsource, since your checklist has to reflect your own unique experience, knowledge, and previous mistakes. It's critical to go through the arduous process of analyzing where things have gone wrong for you in the past, so you can see if there are any recurring patterns or particular areas of vulnerability. We are all different, and we all mess up in ways that are often quite personal to us. For example, some investors are temperamentally drawn to the opportunities available in highly leveraged companies. I'm not, so I don't need to have as many checklist items that warn me to tread carefully in this kind of risky environment. By contrast, Monish is less fearful of heavily indebted companies, so this is one area where he might need to be more cautious. Similarly, an investor like Bill Ackman seems drawn to opportunities involving controversial stocks where the management may be bamboozling gullible investors. If I were Bill, I'd have a checklist item that said, "Am I being drawn into this situation not because it's the best investment I can make, but because I enjoy the thrill of the investigative chase and want to right the wrongs of the world?" This is not a criticism of Bill, who is a superb investor and who would have made an equally outstanding investigative journalist. It's a matter of looking at our idiosyncrasies and understanding where they tend to lead us. In my case, it's particularly important for me to feel that people like me. I also find it hard to say no to people I like. This makes me vulnerable in certain situations, as these emotional needs could short-circuit my rational judgment. To help counter this, my checklist includes questions such as, is there some way in which this investment idea is being sold to me? Does someone in this situation have an axe to grind? Who benefits if I make this investment? Does this investment appeal to any personal biases of mine that should be re-examined? Given my nature, it makes sense to explore this question of whether I might be trying to fulfill some other part of my personality instead of just maximizing my returns. A checklist is a way of managing your own mind and guarding against your own proclivities, so it needs to be based on this kind of self-awareness. My other caveat is that a checklist is emphatically not a shopping list of the desirable attributes that we're looking for in a business. I've seen investment checklists that ask questions like, is this company cheap? Or, does it have a high return on equity? In my opinion, this is a misguided way to use checklists. I prefer to use them in much the same way that pilots use them. They don't ask, does this plane fly fast? Or, am I flying to a sunny destination? Rather, the items on their checklists are designed to help them avoid mistakes that have previously led to plane crashes. In investing too, the real purpose of a checklist is to serve as a survival tool based on the haunting remembrance of things past. But the best way to explain this is to provide you with some real-world examples of how I developed my checklist. Here then are four brief case studies, situations in which I made costly investment errors that then led me to develop specific checklist items. The point is not just to relish this humbling account of various low points in my stock-picking career, it's to get a clearer sense of how you might analyze your mistakes and blind spots in order to construct a checklist of your own. Case Study 1. The Man Who Lost His Cool. Back in 2001, when I was living in Manhattan, I began to make an array of investments in companies that provided for-profit education. I travelled all over the world to learn more about these businesses, searching wide and deep for good companies in the same sector. I flew to Singapore, Shanghai, and Mumbai to research one of the global leaders, Raffles Education Corporation, and I dispatched my analyst to the Philippines. But it turned out that some of the most intriguing companies in the industry were in my own backyard. I put together a list of all the for-profit educational institutions in New York City and went door-to-door on my BMW motorcycle to check them out. At the time, I must have known more about the sector than almost any other investor in America, and I loved riding that bike. During these visits, I came across an obscure college called Interborough Institute, which was owned by EVCI Career Holdings Corp. This company's enterprising management team had come up with an innovative way of providing a college education to students with limited resources, many of whom had failed to graduate from high school. The students typically received financial aid grants that exceeded the cost of Interborough's bare-bones education, so they were educated for free while EVCI made money in the process. This model later came under fire, but I attended at least three graduation ceremonies at Interborough and saw for myself that it provided real social value. Essentially, it helped less-than-stellar students to get a degree and move on to jobs in fields like medical billing and insurance administration, instead of remaining in menial work such as packing groceries. During the early stages of my research, I mentioned EVCI to Whitney Tilson, and we ended up visiting the company together in Yonkers. The business was doing well, but EVCI was hobbled by $2 million in debt that it had issued to acquire Interborough. In June 2003, Whitney and I invested $1 million each in EVCI, which relieved the company of this debt burden and invigorated the business. Meanwhile, the number of students at Interborough grew rapidly, profits surged, and my $1 million investment soared to $7 million in 18 months. This was part of the benefit of running a small fund like Aquamarine. I could take a meaningful position in a tiny company like this, which operated way below the radar of larger funds. It was thrilling, too, to see how my legwork had paid off. All in all, this investment felt like a triumph. I felt really proud. When a stock takes flight like that, there's a sense of joyous wonder. Wow, you think, that's real money. With EVCI's operating income and stock both up sevenfold, the board agreed to grant huge pay rises to the company's two top executives. The chairman slash CEO would see his base salary rise from $326,000 a year to $621,000, and the president's base salary would jump from $267,000 to $483,000. I was grateful for their astute management of the company up to that point, and I wanted them to get rich alongside their investors, but this was a minuscule company that had generated less than $3.5 million in operating profits the previous year. Their pay hike meant that these two executives would now take roughly a quarter of the operating profits in cash for themselves. To me and to other investors, that was an outrageous amount for a company of this size. After all, who owns the company, the management or the shareholders? In retrospect, I should have sold my shares right then. I was shocked and upset. This struck me as a short-sighted and self-serving business decision, and I fired off a forthright letter to the management and the board, describing the compensation plan, somewhat tactlessly, as inane, and complaining that it undermined investors' confidence in them. For a start, I explained, the plan was financially inefficient, since a big slug of the profits would now go to the IRS to pay income taxes. Even worse, these hefty salaries would have to be declared in the company's proxy documents for all to read. Interborough's competitors were in the state sector, where educational administrators had no opportunity to earn that kind of money. I was worried that these inflated salaries would spark resentment, not least among New York State's education authorities. This could result in unwanted reviews of Interborough's business and possibly even a withdrawal of its education license. My letter suggested what seemed to me a compelling alternative. I said I was willing to use my influence as a substantial shareholder to pass a compensation plan that would give the two top executives a generous grant of stock options. If the stock kept climbing, they could each make tens of millions of dollars. This struck me as a strong incentive and an appropriate reward for enriching their shareholders, but I received no reply from the management or the board of directors. I found this inexplicable. Here I was, offering to help them make a fortune, yet they didn't even deign to respond. Convinced that my arguments would win him over, I arranged to meet EVCI's chairman/CEO for lunch at a restaurant near his office in Yonkers. Our conversation seemed cordial until suddenly all hell broke loose. He began shouting at me at the top of his voice, and the whole restaurant fell into stunned silence. It felt like a scene from a movie. I don't remember his exact words, but I think he yelled, "Are you accusing me of lying?" He also said something to the effect of, "Who the hell do you think you are?" I froze and had no idea how to react. I thought I was offering him an opportunity to make enormous sums. In return, he seemed determined to humiliate me publicly. This was an astounding turn of events. What I discovered much later was that he was going through a bitter divorce. According to a 2009 decision from the New York Court of Appeals, he and his wife were fighting over their marital assets, including his stock in EVCI. His wife commenced divorce proceedings in 2003. A trial ensued, and she was later granted a divorce on the grounds of abandonment. In 2006, the trial court rejected his claims that the appreciation in the value of the EVCI stock was due solely to his efforts, and it used the trial date for valuation purposes of his stock and options. In other words, he was in the midst of a wrenching war over money, and specifically over his stake in EVCI. This helps to explain why he blew up at me when I proposed that he reverse the decision to increase his salary and instead receive a massive payday only if the stock performed well. Perhaps his concern was that a major portion of this future wealth might end up going to his ex-wife. In any event, he must have felt under attack from every side. And of course we know how difficult it is to act rationally when money is at stake. In my opinion, the chairman/CEO was a smart and decent person, but it seemed to me that he had landed in a difficult position that didn't bring out the best in him. Our contentious lunch was an augury of more trouble to come. EVCI's stock soon halved, at which point I finally sold my shares. As I had predicted, the company also lost favor with the state education authorities. In 2007, the New York Board of Regents enacted new test regulations that made it much harder for Interborough students to receive financial aid. The company was also ordered to repay millions of dollars in student aid funds after it turned out that some of its students had been ineligible for the money they received. In December 2007, the Chronicle of Higher Education reported that EVCI had decided to close Interborough down after it realized that most of its students would no longer qualify for state or federal student aid. The company was also hit with a class action lawsuit for securities fraud. It was an ignominious end to what had once seemed an inspiring success story. Later, when I performed a post-mortem on my various investing mistakes, I re-examined what had happened at EVCI and tried to draw some practical lessons from the experience. For me, one of the most important was that I needed to be more conscious of the extent to which the life circumstances of top executives could affect their decision-making and their ability to manage the business. If I have even a mild argument with my wife, it can put me out of sorts for the day, affecting both my mood and my ability to make intelligent decisions, so I can only imagine how hard it would be to go through a contentious divorce. Indeed, this is just one example of the many life events that can knock an executive off track. It might also be a family bereavement, a major dispute with a business partner, or even extreme levels of personal debt. Life is messy, and we all go through trying times, but it's important to recognize that senior management, like the rest of us, can be derailed by this kind of personal turmoil. After all, when a person's back is up against the wall, it increases the likelihood that their judgment will suffer. So I added a couple of items to my checklist as a formal reminder of some hard-earned lessons, courtesy of this education company. Checklist items. Are any of the key members of the company's management team going through a difficult personal experience that might radically affect their ability to act for the benefit of their shareholders? Also, has this management team previously done anything self-serving that appears dumb? Case Study 2. A Tortuous Tale of Tupperware. The Tupperware Plastics Company was founded in 1938 by Earl Silas Tupper, who had previously worked at DuPont Chemical. He fashioned Tupperware's first containers out of polyethylene slag, a waste product from oil refining. Today, his iconic brand of plastic containers is sold in about 100 countries. Instead of selling these goods in stores, the company's strategy relies upon a legion of consultants who organize Tupperware home parties at which the host receives free items in return for inviting guests to see the product line. Back in the late 90s, I became intrigued with Tupperware, which seemed to embody all of the attributes of a high-quality business. I was particularly impressed with its exceptional profit margins and return on equity. Here was a company that could take $5 worth of plastic and turn it into a piece of Tupperware that sold for $50. The company generated lots of cash and it didn't need much capital. Plus, I remembered Munger talking about Tupperware parties in his lecture on human misjudgment. He said these parties exemplified an array of the manipulative psychological tricks that Robert Cialdini had discussed in his books. The overall effect was said to be so powerful that housewives bought masses of Tupperware despite its high price. I wanted to experience this firsthand, so a friend and I hosted a Tupperware party in my apartment in New York. I was awed to see these psychological forces at play. For a start, there was the reciprocation principle. As the hosts, we knew that we'd get some free Tupperware based on how much was sold at the party, so we were already grateful to the Tupperware lady for agreeing to organize the event, and we were excited about the free containers we'd receive as our reward. Then, at the start of the event, the Tupperware lady handed out a small gift to everyone so that none of our guests would leave empty-handed. The result? Everybody at the party was itching to reciprocate, just as Cialdini would have predicted. Another psychological force at play was the liking principle. We liked the friends we had invited, and they liked us. Once the Tupperware lady had handed out free gifts, we all liked her too. Half an hour earlier, she had been a complete stranger. Now she was not just a friend, but a member of our team. The list goes on. For example, the authority principle was also at work, since she knew a remarkable amount about food, which enhanced her authority as a Tupperware salesperson. There was also a scarcity factor at play, since she hadn't brought enough items to satisfy all of the demand among our guests. And did I mention that the Tupperware containers came in all these really bright, vivid colors that also caught our attention? In short, the party was a brilliant example of sales psychology at its most effective. In a couple of hours, our Tupperware lady sold more than $2,000 worth of the product, earning herself nearly $1,000. Having seen this phenomenon in person, I felt that I understood why the company was so successful. Its superior performance was based on the remarkable psychological effects unleashed at these parties. Plus, I could see that there was endless opportunity for Tupperware in emerging markets, even though the developed world might already be saturated. Armed with these insights, I pretty much raced out to buy the stock. I was secure in the knowledge that every 2 minutes, someone was hosting a Tupperware party somewhere in the world, and that these principles would be playing themselves out. Sadly, I was wrong. While some investments fail quickly, this one failed slowly, and that can be far more damaging to an investment portfolio, because these slow losers suck up an enormous amount of your mental energy over an extended period of time. For as long as I owned Tupperware, one region or another was always performing badly. Sales simply weren't growing. I would listen in on the company's quarterly conference calls to find out what was going wrong. These calls reassured me that the management was highly competent and working hard, but as I gradually realized, the company faced a fundamental problem. There was too much competition, and the high price of its products had become a serious obstacle to growth. It was only after a couple of years that I really figured out what was going on. When Tupperware first hit the market, its products were unique. Customers willingly paid a premium for its promise of sealed-in freshness, but over the decades, many other competitors got into the game, and their seals improved until they were just as good. These rival products may not have been as attractive, but they were cheaper, and they were easily available in supermarkets. As a result, Tupperware could no longer justify its high price for a simple product. Despite the management team's abundant skills, they couldn't alter this harsh economic reality. As Buffett once remarked, when a management team with a reputation for brilliance tackles a business with a reputation for bad economics, it is the reputation of the business that remains intact. I finally capitulated in the summer of 1999, selling the stock for more or less what I had paid for it a couple of years earlier. Looking back on this disappointing investment, it was clear that I had failed to ask the most obvious question: does this product offer good value for money? After the positive experience of hosting a Tupperware party, I had become too committed psychologically to the idea of owning the stock, and I lacked the detachment to see the pitfalls. This misadventure taught me an invaluable lesson. I want to invest only in companies that are a win-win for their entire ecosystem. In consultant speak, we'd refer to the ecosystem as the value chain. The terminology doesn't matter. What's important is the idea that a great company makes tons of money while adding real value for its customers. Originally, Tupperware had done this by introducing an innovative product. Now, no more. By contrast, consider a world-beating business like Walmart, or for that matter, Costco, Geico, or Amazon.com. Walmart works hard to make everything it sells less expensive for the consumer, constantly driving more costs out of its distribution system. This pleases its customers, so they bring more of their business to Walmart each year. You might think that Walmart's suppliers would be resentful since their margins are getting squeezed, but the suppliers benefit from the sheer volume of sales generated in Walmart's stores. Everybody in this ecosystem wins. Walmart and its shareholders, its suppliers, and its customers. That said, I've never owned Walmart, since the company was already too large and the stock too expensive to meet my criteria. And of course, Walmart has critics who would argue that its success comes at the expense of local businesses and its own workforce. In future, I determined to do a better job of analyzing the whole value chain to identify companies that make it more efficient. This analysis would have saved me from my Tupperware mistake. It has also kept me away from companies as diverse as Philip Morris, a phenomenally profitable business that is damaging to its customers' health, and Greece's national lottery firm, OPAP, a phenomenally profitable business that is damaging to its customers' wealth. Both of these companies have a license to print money, but they do so by preying on people's weaknesses. For the consumer and for society at large, this is not a win-win proposition. Personally, I don't want to invest in companies that make society worse, even if their products are legal. Call me irrational, but I think it's bad karma. In any case, I much prefer to invest in businesses that benefit society. Once again, in learning this lesson, I realized that Buffett already knew it. As far as I'm aware, every one of his holdings meets this high standard. Checklist item. Is this company providing a win-win for its entire ecosystem? Case study 3. What lies beneath? My study of companies like Walmart and Costco led me to invest in CarMax, the Walmart or Costco of second-hand cars. Since opening its first store in Virginia in 1993, CarMax has sold over 4 million cars, and it currently boasts about 100 stores across America. It's a highly efficient operation with a narrow spread between what it pays for cars and the price at which it sells them. Customers know that the sales prices in its big box stores are among the lowest around, and there's a huge selection of cars on display, ranging from two-year-old Mercedes SUVs to Mustang convertibles from the 1950s. There is one other key aspect to the CarMax business model. It provides customers with access to financing. In the United States, a significant portion of cars are leased. Without financing, many CarMax customers wouldn't be able to buy its cars. In fact, if CarMax were to find that it couldn't access the debt markets, its whole business model would fall apart. And in 2008, it did fall apart. Sales plummeted because CarMax and its customers could no longer obtain credit amid the global financial crisis. As a result, the stock price crashed. Once again, I discovered the importance of understanding a company's entire value chain. I hadn't given sufficient thought to just how dependent CarMax was on the credit markets and how vulnerable this made the business. I might well have made the purchase anyway. After all, I could never have predicted the severity of the credit crisis. But this situation taught me how critical it is to discern whether a business is overly exposed to part of the value chain that it can't control. If this is the case, as it often is, I need to be compensated for that heightened risk with a lower purchase price. In response to this experience, I developed a checklist item that allows me to get a deeper sense of the quality of the business. One way to word this item might be, are the company's revenues leveraged to the credit markets? But I don't get too hung up on the exact wording that I use in my checklist. A more general version of this item might be, how does this company sit within the value chain, and what parts of this business could be impacted by changes in other parts of the value chain that this company has very little influence over? The point is that I want to invest in companies that control their own destiny, not in companies that have their destiny determined by forces beyond their control. It's also possible to use this way of thinking to identify some great investment opportunities. The goal in these situations is to find companies where one aspect of the value chain has gone awry, dragging down the whole business. If I believe this problem is temporary, I can buy the stock at a beaten-down price and then benefit once this issue within the value chain is resolved. In 2007, this thought process led me to invest in Alaska Milk, the dominant producer of condensed milk in the Philippines. The company's key ingredient was powdered milk that had to be imported from abroad. When the global price of powdered milk shot up, the company's profit margins were squeezed and its stock plunged. I was convinced that the price of powdered milk would eventually return to normal as supply rose to match increased demand from China. As a result, Alaska Milk's profits would rebound. This proved correct, and I made about 5 times my money in 5 years. Checklist item. How could this business be affected by changes in other parts of the value chain that lie beyond the company's control? For example, are its revenues perilously dependent on the credit markets or the price of a particular commodity? Case Study 4. How I Lost My Balance. Smart Balance, which has since been renamed Boulder Brands, was an innovative food company led by a superstar marketer named Stephen Hughes. Its flagship product is a blend of vegetable and fruit oils that competes with leading margarines such as Shed's Country Crock and I Can't Believe It's Not Butter. Smart Balance's spread is based on an oil blending process patented by food scientists at Brandeis University, and it offers a genuinely healthy alternative to rival spreads that are rich in trans fatty acids. By contrast, Smart Balance's spread is said to lower consumers' bad cholesterol and to raise their good cholesterol. Following its launch in 1997, it breezed past Land O'Lakes to become the number 3 brand in the margarine category. As a long-time shareholder of Nestlé, I had seen functional products like this become a fast-growing and increasingly profitable niche within the food industry. I figured that Smart Balance, as a smaller and nimbler player, would grow rapidly for the next 5 or so years in both the margarine category and related businesses such as peanut butter and popcorn. At that point, it would get bought out by a larger competitor. I also liked the fact that Smart Balance had outsourced its manufacturing and distribution, so it was a pure marketing and branding company, and its management team was quite something. Hughes enjoyed a remarkable reputation. He had famously turned around Tropicana's juice business in the United States before achieving similarly impressive feats with brands like Celestial Seasonings Tea and Silk Soy Milk. An article about smart balance in Fortune began with the line, "Success has followed Steve Hughes wherever he has roamed in the food industry over the past 2 decades. Hughes himself was quoted as saying, "We are positioning this as a brand that could grow to $1 billion, a true mega brand." Back then, I hadn't yet abandoned my practice of meeting with management. Hughes came to my office, and I quickly fell under his spell. It wasn't just that he had a superb resume. He was also incredibly smart and charismatic, a wonderful guy who, for good reason, was widely liked and admired. Already, his top-notch team had been successful in gaining distribution for Smart Balance at Walmart, and I observed for myself how much shoppers there liked the brand. At the same time, an analyst who was working for me loved the stock and was desperate for me to buy it, partly because it was frustrating to work for a long-term investor who so rarely acquired a new holding. Confident that we had found a winner, I bought Smart Balance in 2007. There was just one problem. I overpaid. Of course, I didn't realize this.